Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, everyone. Welcome to the New Year's Eve broadcast of Italian Tomatoes. Everyone, welcome to the New Year's Eve 2015 broadcast of Italian Tomatoes. We are going to take a retrospective look at the year, starting with financial markets and then going on to the political scene. The chat is open if you wish to participate in the chat. And to call into the show, the number is 646-478-0004. That's 646-478-0004. I think the show will be about an hour tonight. I haven't really promoted the show, so I'm not expecting much live participation. One of the guys from Free Fire Friday has dropped by in the chat, so I want to welcome him. And didn't want to promote it on Twitter because Twitter is crazy on New Year's Eve, and sometimes when it's in a crazy mood, you don't want people dropping in from Twitter. So I didn't put the show out on Twitter. I'll put the podcast out, but not the live show. This is by invitation only, and as I imagine, most people are kind of busy on New Year's Eve. I don't expect many to drop in, but it's always nice when somebody drops in. Markets. Interesting stuff going on. During the day, I was looking at all of my financial email subscriptions where you get news bulletins from the various financial services. And interesting stuff. The stock market had zero gain in 2016. And that kind of is illustrative of the fate of the economy as a whole. Jobs are stagnant. Growth is stagnant. Unemployment is down because people are dropping out of the labor force. Many of the new jobs that are being created are going to the record number of immigrants that we're seeing on both ends of the economic ladder. On the top rungs, professional and technical jobs are increasingly going to the H-1B and related visa holders that are being brought into the country en masse. And on the lower rungs of the ladder, you have other visa programs like H-2B, which bring in a lot of legal immigrants to take lower-paid jobs. And, of course, you have the continued surge of illegal immigration, and illegal immigrants also take up a lot of lower-wage jobs. So the economic picture, although superficially the economic statistics are, somewhat cheerful, the reality is kind of gloomy, and that was definitely seen in the retail sector, which had a lot of disappointments in the month of December related to sales, related to the battle between traditional retailers and online retailers, related to the weather, because we had unusually warm weather for part of the Christmas shopping season, and that tends to depress sales, especially in apparel. So stocks posted their worst annual performance since 2008. The Dow Jones Industrial Average, which is 30 industrial or equivalent stocks, because they're not all industrial anymore, lost 2.2% in 2015, while the broader S&P 500 index was down slightly under 1%. So investors have gotten hit with a basically zero year this year, and they had been accustomed to very big increases in the prior 3 years. So there is an adjustment process going on. The market can only go so high on the current state of its earnings, and its earnings are flatlining. Interest rates are starting to nudge up. So it's kind of interesting to see what we will have in the job market, and because of the stock market. The other big economic trend was the decline in oil prices. Oil prices are down 30% for the year. You see it all the time at the gas pump. Crude was $50 a barrel at the beginning of the year. It closed to the upper 30s, around the $37 level. So huge decline in energy in prices, and of course that was followed by a huge decline in energy employment. And on the employment picture, we have the continued restructuring of big American companies and the attendant layoffs. That is not stopping. That continues to go on, regardless of the downward trend in the unemployment rate and regardless of the general strength of the economy. The companies are always restructuring. So there are a lot of jobs that have been lost in the past year, and there are jobs that will continue to be lost as companies restructure, as they continue on this H-1B visa kick, as they merge and sell themselves and restructure and what have you. So the first clip I want to play is a humorous clip. It's one of the ones I generally play. Just to illustrate what goes on when people lose their jobs and all the stress they go under, this is from the Frasier show. This is a very funny segment where Frasier is renegotiating his contract with the radio station, and he's currently unemployed because the negotiations haven't been concluded yet, and so he's sweating out a renegotiation. So this is a couple of minutes.
Why are you so tense? This is the best part. What could be more fun than this?
Watching a loved one be autopsied.
Think of them sweating in their offices, chain smoking, biting their nails, their ulcers churning out enough acid to burn a hole in a ship's hull. Oh, God. And to think I nearly went into nursing.
Oh, you're right, Peavy, you're right. God, they're foolish enough to let me go. Well, then, fine. There are any number of other stations that would love to have Frasier Crane on board.
Exactly.
Yes. But, you know, in fact, I think it's time maybe we discussed those other offers. Consider what our fallback position should be.
Ooh, someone's out of scotch.
Peavy, tell me there are other offers.
Scared!
Now, you look me in the eye and tell me the truth.
There are no other offers. straight up or on the rocks.
Don't.
Darling, you can't make a deal without bluffing a little.
You're supposed to bluff them, not me. My God, woman, are you trying to ruin me?
You are such a worrywart.
Now, don't you patronize me, you sweet-talking succubus. You get on the phone and call them.
Oh, my God, hands of Hercules. What must your legs be like?
Answer it.
Not yet. Where are we? Have we gone out? Is it too late?
Answer it!
Crane residence. B.B. Glazer speaking. It's them. I see. I see. Fine.
Well?
Renegotiations tomorrow, starting from scratch.
Oh, my God. So pleased. Thank you, B.B.
Maybe next time you'll trust little B.B.
Yes. Oh, I'm so sorry.
Well, that was a clip of from the Frasier show. In that segment, Frasier is renegotiating his contract. They hadn't reached an agreement yet, so he's technically out of a job, and he's being represented by his crazy agent, B.B. Glazer, whose approach to renegotiating a contract is to push the envelope to the edge of destruction and then maybe a little past it, trying to get the best deal possible. And although he wasn't laid off in the strictest sense of the term, the clip does give a humorous glimpse at what goes on when people are having an unstable employment situation, and really the lack of equality between a person of relatively limited financial resources and a big company when it comes to reaching an agreement in negotiations. I mean, obviously, the big corporate player has the upper hand, and that's one of the things that makes looking for a job in the current job market so stressful. Okay, now as far as the show, the plan of the show, we're going to cut over to Times Square in a few minutes, but we're also going to launch our political discussion, and I'm going to do that now. One of the things I wanted to talk about this evening was the whole concept of dynasty, and I'm going to focus a lot on Hillary Clinton. We've seen in recent years that the concept of political dynasty is getting more controversial as families, as the political families, the well-connected political families, get more aggressive and entrenched. One of the interesting things, we've always had political dynasties in this country, but in the old days, families relied on either inherited private wealth or entrepreneurship to accumulate the money which let them go into politics. Nowadays, they are more reliant on proximity to government and using their connections with government to increase private wealth. So one of the terms that you hear all the time is crony capitalism. Another thing that characterizes the behavior of dynasties recently is the increasing in-your-face aggressiveness of them. There used to be an informal one-generation-must-pass rule where the representative of a very famous family would achieve high office, and then no one from that family would try again until a generation had passed. We saw that with the Adamses, the Harrisons, the Roosevelts, and then it started to change. I mean, interesting, I mean, just bringing up the Roosevelts, I mean, Eleanor Roosevelt wouldn't have dreamed of running for president just a few years after her husband had served as president. But, of course, now Hillary Clinton has no qualms at all about making a go for of it based on her connection to the office when she was first lady. The Kennedys tested the one generation rule, and after John Kennedy was established, Robert Kennedy ran for the office, and he might have made it, but of course, tragically, he was assassinated. Then Teddy tried, but he failed because he was too scandal-plagued. And then the dynasty factor kind of died down a little bit. And then it came back with a vengeance under both the Bushes and the Clintons, who have been trying to break and have been succeeding in breaking the one-generation-must-pass rule. George W. Bush succeeded because there was a lot of buyer's remorse with respect to Bill Clinton because of the Clinton scandals, even though the public did not want Bill Clinton impeached. It kind of got disgusted with the general tone of the sleazy factor of the White House during the last few years of his presidency, and that made it easier for George W. Bush to win the nomination and the election, capitalizing on the buyer's remorse factor. People began to appreciate his father more, especially his performance in the Gulf War and the relative lack of scandal in the George H.W. Bush administration. And there was this kind of desire to return to normalcy, and that was represented by W. Well, of course, after 8 years of W., the luster was dimmed considerably. And then, of course, Hillary tried to get the office in 2008 based on her role in the Clinton presidency, her husband's presidency. She failed because the anti-dynastic impulse reasserted itself. She was a terrible campaigner. Barack Obama was telegenic and unknown, and a lot of people could project into him whatever they wanted to project, and of course he would be the first African American president. And now the Bushes are trying again in the form of Jeb Bush, and of course Hillary is succeeding. She's almost certain to win the Democratic nomination in 2016, unless she's indicted with one of her scandals. So the dynastic impulse is on the ascendant again, and where it's going to take us, God only knows. And of course, if Donald Trump ever becomes president with all that money he has, and he's got a huge family, and they're bright, aggressive kids that he has, we will see if another dynasty gets launched. And I think it's Richard in chat saying Hillary would be the first known criminal president. Well, could be. Okay. So I think what I'm going to do now is I'm not going to play my Dick. Well, I guess I do have time for the first Dick Morris clip, and then we'll shift over to Times Square. Dick Morris is, having worked for the Clintons, as well as many Republican politicians, has a unique insight into the workings of our political system, and I subscribe to his video newsletter. I find it very informative. He interviewed Ed Klein, the author of Blood Feud, and which details the antagonism between two dynasties, the current Obama dynasty, which definitely has dynastic potential down the road, and the Clintons. So I'm going to play a few minutes of this, and then we will shift over to Times Square.
Hi. We're here with Ed Klein, who is the best-selling author of a million books, but the one before this was called Blood Feud, The Obamas and the Clintons. And this one is called Unlikable, which is a very insightful discussion of Hillary and elaborates on the Obama-Clinton relationship. And this isn't just People magazine gossip stuff. This is the centrally most important fact of American politics today, how these two political dynasties are getting along with each other or not. I gather it's not.
It's certainly not. I was stunned by the intrigue, the backstabbing, the deception that goes on at the highest levels of the Democratic Party between these two great families. It's sort of like a real-life Game of Thrones.
Yep, or Capulet and Montague.
That's right.
Hatfield and McCoys. But what I find fascinating about your description of it is that you indicate that the Bill-Barack relationship is bad, but that on an entirely different level, the Michelle-Valerie-Hillary relationship is bad for different reasons.
Well, you know, one of the things I discovered is that when Michelle and Valerie go up to the family quarters of the White House and open a bottle of Chardonnay at night after dinner, they talk about a lot of things. They often talk about Hillary, and one of the subjects that comes up from time to time, believe it or not, is the speech that Hillary gave in 1969 at Wellesley College when she took out after Senator Edward Brooke, the first African-American senator since Reconstruction.
Incredible.
And they hold her responsible for this attack on a black man.
Wow.
And they have said, according to my sources who have spoken to Valerie Jarrett, that maybe the Clintons aren't really any more racist than any other white people.
Wow. And that's, of course, with Bill Clinton, who always prided himself on being the most non-racist of all the Southern politicians.
Yes.
Really went out of his way on that. But it seems to emanate from a more basic thing. What do you think Valerie and Michelle have against Hillary?
I think they're very concerned, not only personally and ideologically, that Hillary will not carry out the legacy, that she doesn't have principles, that she'll give in to the Republicans if she's president, undo a lot of the Obama legacy. But there's also another element to this, which is pure power. Because right now, who controls the Democratic Party and its apparatus and all the patronage and all the commissions and all the money?
Hillary, because they put Wasserman Schultz
right.
on.
Exactly.
Charge.
And they're very concerned, the Obamas, that if Hillary becomes president and Bill is part of all this, which he will be, that the Democratic Party will be smothered by the Clintons and exclude any influence at all that the Obamas might have.
That's a point worth making. One of the fundamental rights of every president is to appoint his party's chairman, and every president has always exercised that. And the fact that the Clintons took that position away from the Obamas is a very important fact.
It certainly is. I mean, Debbie Wasserman Schultz was Obama's original appointment, but she has turned her back on the Obamas and now is in the Clinton camp.
Yep. So, but Obama's dislike, President Obama's dislike of President Clinton,
yeah.
I gather, is of a more visceral level.
It is. You know, they both attended Vernon Jordan's 80th birthday, the great African-American figure in the Democratic Party, in Martha's Vineyard, and played golf together, Obama and Clinton. And I'm told by my sources that they really went at each other in the golf course, yelling and gesticulating, and all about the fact that Obama has refused to endorse Hillary, which Bill cannot understand and accept.
And behind that, there's also Bill's constantly taunting Obama about his economic record compared to Obama's.
That's right.
Yeah.
Yes.
I created 400,000 jobs a month. How about you?
You know, Bill gets on the phone and talks regularly to the Democratic leadership in the House and the Senate, to a lot of elected officials. He often tells them things that that's against Obama's policies. Obama hears about that, it drives him absolutely crazy.
Well, when he named Hillary, I coined the phrase menage à trois. It seems that's what's unfolding. But this relationship is not just, as I said, the subject of gossip. It's terribly politically actionable because it now looks as if Obama is encouraging Biden to get into the race.
I think he is, and so is Valerie Jarrett. My sources tell me that after Biden's son, Beau, died at the age of 46, Valerie actually has taken Biden sort of under her wing, helped him with his grieving process, whispered in his ear more than once, you know, Joe, we're behind you. If you want to go and challenge Hillary, we'll give you the backing support of the White House, and we will do everything we can to get that minority vote for you.
Yeah, very, very interesting. It's interesting. I just looked at a poll, and Hillary at the moment is getting half the black vote, but Biden is getting a quarter.
I know.
And he's not announced. He's not even a deciding
candidate. You can't win as a Democrat if you don't have that minority vote.
Now, if I have one criticism of your book, it's that it did not cover Sanders much. Do you think that Sanders is on the Obama radar screen?
No. A simple answer. I just don't think he thinks he's got a chance.
Okay. That interview was recorded before Biden signaled that he would not stay in the race. But, of course, Obama still has a lot of leverage over Hillary Clinton because of her legal problems. And it is Obama's Department of Justice that makes the ultimate decision whether or not to prosecute Hillary for all of the national security breaches that were represented by her emails. So the jury is still out on this kind of godfather kind of scenario, the political intrigue and all the rest of it that goes on. And it just shows the power of these rival dynasties in Washington, D.C., which is something that, you know, it's more intense, in my opinion, than it has been in any other time in American history. We are now seeing this trend peak. It's always been there. It's waned on and off. Well, now it's really on the ascendant. Okay. Well, it is New Year's Eve. It's 3 minutes to the ball drop. I key my New Year's to the ball drop in Times Square because I am from New York originally, so we're going to scoot over there. 50 seconds. So, Happy New Year, based on New York time, to anybody who is listening in either live, which I think is Richard, or in archive, who will be whomever listens to the podcast version of this show. That was New Year's Eve, the ball drop at Times Square. When I lived in New York, I went to New York a few New Years, but I never went to Times Square. I just went into the city to party until the early hours of the morning. And, I mean, when you're in your 20s, there's simply no place that is as fun as New York, unfortunately. I left my 20s in my rearview mirror a long time ago, so my party days are really behind me, but I have very fond memories of going to New York, on going into Manhattan on New Year's Eve. And by the looks of that crowd, the alcohol breath content, one match would make Times Square explode because it's very cold up there and they are well tanked up to deal with it and everybody is having a good time. I was looking at the at television earlier in the day and they were going into all of the security precautions. And, you know, New York police are very thorough, they're very professional, and the city has this schizophrenic love-hate relationship with the police. Because in order to patrol and police a city of that size and complexity, the police can be overbearing, very overbearing. And at the same time, if they don't do it, the city starts breaking down in disorder. And it's a bit of a catch-22. The police were really whipsawed in 2015. Because of the, you know, the terrible thing that happened with the racial tensions where a couple of cops were murdered in cold blood. And prior to that, the mayor of New York had been on this big anti-police kick. He was criticizing them in the wake of the things that went on with Trayvon Martin and Ferguson and all of that. And then the city itself had a what I would think is a wrongful death at the hands of a police officer. And then there was this big pendulum swing against the police, and then the cops were murdered, and the whole thing is such a stinking mess, which is what you get in your government whenever you let liberals run it, in my view, but that is my own opinion. Okay, well, like I said, tonight's show is going to be on the short side. If anybody wants to call in, the number is 646-478-0004. That's 646-478-0004. I have one Hillary clip that I'm going to play, and then we'll see if there's any more live participation, and if not, we'll call it a night. I think I did cover what I wanted to on the markets. So I will switch over to my Hillary clip. And this is another Ed Klein, Dick Morris interview. And this goes into Hillary's health issues and her just general frame of mind. As far as her mental fitness to be president, you know, one of the things that you deal with when your politics switches to dynastic mode is the physical peculiarities of the incumbent monarch, which are largely determined by heredity and health issues. And this is something that, you know, Americans need to think about if they opt more and more for the dynastic solution in choosing their political leadership. And it's troubling to me. I mean, we saw the problems that were created when a very entrenched Franklin Roosevelt ran for a fourth term, which he never should have done. And to the credit of the Democratic Party leadership of the time, knowing Roosevelt was in as bad a state of health as he was in, they dumped Henry Wallace, who was a very left-leaning person, from the ticket and put Harry Truman on as his vice president because they had a sense that Roosevelt wouldn't make it. These days, the political parties don't have a machine apparatus that's strong enough to do stuff like that. So whatever the dynastic principal puts in the top chair, we're kind of stuck with it. So food for thought. Well, here's Dick Morris and Ed Klein just discussing Hillary's health, which in my view should be a very big campaign issue.
Pushing around and yelling and screaming at her campaign advisors. one case, a young woman who's very low level, more than an intern but not a major figure, didn't do exactly what Hillary wanted. Hillary started screaming and yelling at her. The woman turned around to leave, and Hillary went out and grabbed her arm and twisted her arm. This is the kind of behavior that they're very concerned will Hillary will demonstrate in public and really ruin her chances.
Mm. I remember that whenever we had negative stuff to tell Hillary or advice she didn't want or to persuade her not to do something she wanted to do, we would all sit, Maggie Williams and Milan Verbier and all of her top staff people, Ann Lewis and me, and we'd sit outside her office and we'd say, okay, which of us is going to put the bell on the cat's tail? It was kind of a draw straws.
Yes, right.
Well, thank you, Ed.
Thank you so much, Dick.
Now, in our next episode, we're going to talk a little bit more about...
Okay. Well, America has huge problems with the concept of kingship, and George Washington, in his wisdom, declined any hint of a monarchy at the end of the American Revolution. How we will do with the notion of a queen remains to be seen. That is not the profile of a psychological skill set that I would want sitting in the Oval Office, regardless of the politics of the person. And, I mean, that her demeanor actually makes Obama look good by comparison. So I think that the American public has to really think very carefully before they give the nod to Hillary Clinton. And then we have to look at, given her health issues, who the vice president is. Because if she picks a relatively unknown person with unproven qualifications to balance the ticket for, you know, whatever reason, ethnic balance or religious balance or sectional or regional balance, whatever the driving decision factor is, there's a very good chance that we could have a total unknown sitting in the White House in a year or two, just in time to deal with the maturing messes that have mushroomed under the presidency of Barack Obama. So the public needs to think very carefully. And Republicans and independents need to think very carefully about any temptation they might have to not vote because they don't think there's a distinction between the two parties, and their attitude is a plague on both your houses. It doesn't make a difference. Well, be very careful what you wish for. Because you could end up with Hillary, and I don't know, whoever the Republican candidate is going to be far better than Hillary Clinton. And I am perfectly willing to cast my vote for someone who is not my first choice or not my second choice or not my third choice to keep that from happening. And if since Richard is in the chat... we always have very lively discussions on Free Fire Friday, co-hosted by Richard, starring, Johnny Kempin, a show on firearms and other things, Second Amendment, and some political issues, and that is on tomorrow night at 9 o'clock Eastern Time, and just in honor of Richard's presence here, I'll play the theme song for that show.
Johnny Angel, Johnny Angel, Johnny Angel, Johnny Angel, you're an angel to me.
Well, that's not really the theme song, but I figured. Richard does play that a bit, so I figured I would get that in there. Okay. Well, it's not a big night for live participation, so I have one more clip that I want to play, and it's not a political clip. It is a reflective clip. This year, one of my all-time favorite TV shows when I was growing up was The Avengers, the cult classic British television series starring Patrick McNee and Diana Rigg. And Patrick McNee passed away this year, a very gracious gentleman with tremendous wit and style and urbanity, as his family and his co-stars adored him. He had a very interesting life, very unconventional life, and one chapter of his life in his late middle age was living as a nudist in California. So he's not as conventional an English gentleman as you might think. Actually, he was Scotch by ancestry, Scottish. Well, his co-star was, in her day, very big sex symbol in The Avengers. And then she went on to be a Bond girl in the James Bond film on Her Majesty's Secret Service. And then she went on to become an enormously successful stage actress, winning all sorts of awards in the British theater, which, of course, is the gold standard of theater. Well, she appeared some years ago, I think around the millennium, as the new millennium was dawning, to talk about aging. And her perspective on aging is very interesting. It was on the Parkinson Show, British talk show. And I thought, I have a segment in this show called Sexagenarian Reflection, since I'm in my 60s, and thinking about things like aging and passages and stuff like that. And it was very interesting to get her perspective on the aging process. Now, she's talking about it from the perspective of being a woman and an actress, but I think there's elements of truth that apply to everyone, regardless of gender, and to everybody, regardless of profession. So I'm going to play this clip. It's about 6 or 7 minutes long, and then we'll call it an evening.
You've also, not remarkably, quite sensibly, as you got to your 60th year, you became, according to Playboy magazine, one of the sexiest, 100 sexiest women of the century.
God knows how. Being Yorkshire. I don't know. I think it's wonderful. It's terrific, and I'm obviously deeply flattered. But you know what happens when you grow older? You have a choice to make as a woman. I don't think men have to make this choice. I look at photographs, for example, of Sophia Loren, of Claudia Cardinale, of Joan Collins, of all those people who've actually kept that. They're kind of sort of preserved. And it shows that they've a vast amount of self-discipline, but an absolute belief in themselves as a sex symbol, no matter what age they are, right? Now, I couldn't do that. You have to make you make a choice as you grow older. You say, I have to evolve. I have to. I am what I am. And growing old is sort of surprising. You know, you walk along a street and you catch sight of yourself in a shop window and you think, who is that kind of late middle-aged woman? Christ, it's me! But that's the way it is.
But you see, that is interesting because you're in an occupation in which glamour is everything.
Supposedly.
Supposedly.
Yeah.
And the pressure upon an actress particularly. You said men don't have that kind of pressure,
no.
but actors do to retain that which people.
Yeah, I can't think of anything worse, frankly.
You know.
No, because then you getting up in the morning, and you must know this. As you get older, there are mornings when it hurts. Nobody
tells you about the pain as you grow older. But maybe you kind of played, you know, three sets of tennis the day before, and so it hurts the following morning. And then you go and you sit in front of the mirror and you think, dear God, I've got to jack all this up. And I've got to make it all terrific, and I've got to make it look like press rewind. This was 35 years ago, and I haven't changed. And I couldn't bear to do that.
It's interesting, actually, isn't it? Because I suppose that when you were that glamour push back in the sort of 60s, that they take hours manufacturing you, wouldn't they? I mean, in makeup.
They did. Yes. When I was naturally quite attractive.
Yes.
But I spent hours. Now, I'm so bored by the makeup chair that I say to them, you've got 15 minutes. That's it, max. And I'm going in front of the cameras.
It does solve a lot of problems, of course, if you are content with yourself. You can see yourself.
Content is not the point.
Isn't it?
Not quite. No. Growing old is a twofold process. You have to be philosophic about it. You have to laugh about it. And I think you have to enjoy it.
You've also, I mean...
Okay. So that was Diana Rigg talking about some of the accommodations that you have to make to the aging process, and I think that is something well worth pondering as a good segment of our population. My generation is going through a lot of changes related to the aging process, and it also ties into the dynastic discussion. Because I think the families have to realize when their time has come and gone, these big celebrated political families, they have to know when it's time to get off the stage. That, you know, time does pass, and, their moment in the sun, at least temporarily, is done, and they have to make way for newer and fresher faces who have, different background and skill set and ideas. And that's how our country rejuvenates itself. So, you know, the dynasties have to age gracefully, and I don't think they're doing it. They're hanging on too aggressively and too long, and they really don't have anything to offer. With Jeb Bush, I think that became clear as his campaign unfolded. With the Clintons, the dynasty worship in the Democratic Party to date has prevented that healthy impulse from manifesting itself. So we will see what the case is going to be going into 2016. Well, on that note, I'm going to call it an evening. I want to thank Richard from Free Fire Friday of dropping into the chat. Free Fire Friday starring Johnny Kempin is on tomorrow at 9 o'clock Eastern Time. Johnny lives in Alaska, and you will get all sorts of information and insights about hunting and firearms and Alaska from him and his co-host Richard. So it's a fun listen. I'm always calling into that show, so I recommend that you do the same, especially since guns are such a hot topic. I want to wish everybody who listened to the show, Richard and the people who listen in archive to the podcast, a very safe New Year's weekend and a very happy and fulfilling new year. Have a wonderful, wonderful New Year's holiday.